Because how is God working in subtle ways? He's working as the vital life force, the vital awareness of human beings for human beings. Therefore, God is in man already. But man cannot recognize it. He can only feel it. He can't see it. But when he feels it, it is that condition of feeling that impinges on the consciousness for him to act. It makes him act in a more refined, a more sane, sanitary way, and actually a non-destructive way. This is what really works upon him. See, now, one of the strangest things about meditation is that once you break into this consciousness, you can go into it. It's in there alone that the whole library of the universe and its laws of creation come out. When a man said he found some new invention, he didn't find it by his reading in a book, you know. He pondered upon it. And by pondering upon it, the superconsciousness or the intuitive nature came down with the idea from that realm. And then he saw that idea, and then he tried to impress that idea in a geometrical or mathematical form. And from that mathematical form or blueprint, he tries now, in a simple way, and sometimes a complicated way, to take fixed structural matter, to put it together. And each year he's got to keep making a new model of it. You see? But the idea is still there. It's just like the automobile. And the original automobile in Henry Ford's brain is still there. As he saw what it was, he saw the unique engine. And then he started to put it down in a mathematical form, and then he started to take metal and mold it. He saw the inadequacy of the physical thing in relation to the perfect thing he's seen there. So every year there's a constant refinement to get to the perfect thing. But it goes on, you see. Meditation is to keep us always going to the perfection. It's to keep us to go in more and more. So there is no end. That's the beautiful part of it. Now, in meditation, we're going to run into a peculiar problem. There are certain things that occur that appear to duplicate at times this divine law. And these are the functions of the mind, too. It imitates at times. Now, those who were acquainted with the youth movement of using acid, or you call it a psychedelic experience, they do have a certain extension of awareness. But that extension of awareness is not coming from the superconsciousness. It's coming strictly from the subconsciousness. Because the subconsciousness is a reservoir already of that superconsciousness. It's a mirror. So inside of it, that subconsciousness will eventually... Okay, I think...
It's your whole piece.
Yeah.
Or subconsciously you'll be yelling for the other.
The subconsciousness has all these things stored up already as a replica of the superconsciousness. But it cannot add more to it unless the superconsciousness feeds it. You follow? So when the person takes acid or mescaline or any type of psychedelic agent, he only reassesses the subconscious and its mechanics, but he's not adding anything new. But because he has never experienced this, mechanics, this total condition from an objective state in a waking state, it is totally new to him. And it will fit all that he knows about himself to a certain degree until there is a lack of inspiration coming in. There's a lack of inventiveness coming in. There's a lack of self-discovery coming in. So where's the other part? I don't see. Then it started running dry. Then you need another booster. And the more you take the booster, what you're really doing, you're only mapping out your subconscious mind over and over. You're going over the same territory over and over. Now, yet, in a real genuine superconscious awakening, in that light, one may see certain forms of different human beings in different ages and in different style costume. This is the first time they are experiencing different life forms of themselves. That man has always been alive, that the divine life has no end. It only seeks to manifest in forms, human form. And in this awareness, you can open your eyes and close it, and still there, it goes in. Sometimes you can see yourself as an Indian chief. You see yourself as some rich potentate sitting down in Saudi Arabia with a big harem. It all depends on what level of consciousness you go in. Talking about that, I would like you to locate a National Geographical magazine, October 1958. There's something in there I want you to see. If you can locate a National Geographic magazine, 1958. There, but in ourselves, we see these different forms of our past lives. We can see the different forms of our past lives and the levels that we've dropped and the levels that we've risen to. This occurs in there. Now, a master comes along and can do it for you too. It isn't that a man does not get a master to take him up there. As I say, it's the greatest relationship to find a master. But the master is not going to do the work all the time for you. A master is not going to coddle you. A master is only going to act as a insurance policy against certain repercussions. In other words, a master's consciousness is total, like an insurance policy for $100,000. And you're paying up this, you know, the payments. So you start making your first down payment. You got a long way to pay up for $100,000. So you may kick the bucket and you haven't paid up your insurance and it's no good. But the problem with insurance policy is that you don't collect your insurance when you die. You always got to leave this insurance for somebody else. Whereas with a master, he's your insurance policy. He never kicks the bucket and leave you behind, not to collect. When he kicks the bucket, you're still collecting on the master, you see? But the master really doesn't kick the bucket in the sense we're talking about. His consciousness has taken yours into tow. In other words, you have docked into his consciousness already. You're locked into his consciousness. And no matter where you drift in yours, no matter what on the tow you go in your attitude, in your behavior, in the emotional tones of your behavior and your gestures with your fellow man and yourself, you are still locked into his. He cannot let you go away. He pulls you in all the time. Now, as one master would say, if you go into a foreign city, you would avail yourself of the services of a tourist guide who is well acquainted with that city and take you around and show you the town. In superconsciousness or cosmic consciousness would be the most practical thing to avail yourself of a man who's been there all the time, right? So that is one of the advantages of that type of spiritual insurance. It is an insurance policy that pays off in either level. I eat in the level when you're in the body, or the level when you leave the body. It pays off with that association. You know who you're dealing with. You see? Now, saints are considered such an insurance policy. That's why certain religions make their devotees concentrate on a particular saint's picture or saint's body form to impregnate the consciousness, that they have something familiar to latch on to travel in consciousness. But we realize that man is made of flesh and blood, and there's a very little warmth and affinity with marble. When he pays devotion to it. But there is also respect for that marble form. Yet when he sees a human form to which this particular quality is endowed in, he has an animosity. Can that be really true? Then he starts comparison. He starts comparing him with one who is in marble or one who is in a painting, you know. He cannot see the relationship until he goes inside and finds out now that this living one, this one in the physical form, can really work from inside for him. Then he turns the awareness to that particular teacher or that particular master. But until that time, he's going to do it. He's not going to able to look up to him, a living master, as a guide, because he's too preconditioned by the marble form of one past saint or a painting of a past saint. You see? Now, seeing a human form communicating that identical information and that identical experience, and now encouraging him to make the journey in, this is something he can't accept right away, because he's still thinking in terms of his human standards. How does this man maintain himself? What are these values and so forth? What are their emotions? These are things that are going to come up. Now, you can look at the statue of Saint Joseph or Virgin Mary or Saint Thomas or Jesus, and right away you have the reverence, only because their stature, their qualities have already been established and is put down on paper to be recited like a sort of a rotation now, you know, and therefore the reverence is there. Now, to see a human form with these qualities that are being written about, living, is hard to make the transfer, because you cannot see qualities. You have to be constantly exposed, day in and day out. You have to have inner relationships with that human form to see so many different experiences occur for you to realize that it's happening. This is a peculiar thing. Now, some masters, you sit in their presence, you see nothing, feel nothing, and they're doing a whole lot for you. Like one reporter that went to see the Maharishi. That's the, you know, the Beatles guru. The guru of the Beatles. The Maharishi, Munashi Yogi.
I read about him today, Father.
Yeah. He teaches the same thing, meditation. He told the reporter, he says, well, I'm sitting here all the time, but I don't see anything. I haven't got anything out of you. All I've seen is somebody come here and everyone is looking for some word, some magic formula to find peace. I said, I haven't found anything. So
this is a reporter's comment.
And the Maharishi says, well, you may not have found what you were looking for, but I sure gave it to you already.
He sure gave it to you. Oh.
See? Now, How does the reporter know what he was really looking for? When a master tells him, he already gave him what he was looking for, and he can't recognize it.
Before you ask, I answer.
You see? Now, this reporter certainly is going to go searching again all over till he finds some other individual and make the same comment over and over. And the remark to that comment may be the same thing. I've given it to you already. Not realizing what these men are saying. Until one day, when he's so fed up, eventually he will latch on to someone or feel some affinity for someone and then realize that when he's getting it from this person, he's already done get it, you know, from all the rest in the same way, but he couldn't recognize it. Mm-hmm. You see, the Maharishi is saying meditation is simple. It's not a complex, difficult thing. It is something that you take in strides, like sipping.
Well, it's complex from this standpoint. If you have never experienced it, it's still something that's unattainable and you don't even know what you're talking about. If you haven't experienced it, you hardly know what the other fellow's talking about until you do experience it. And then almost no words explain it, it seems.
Yeah.
It can sound, I know the first time I heard about meditation, it was just so many words running through my mind, and it bore no relation to anything that I could understand, really. And then after the first little teensy weensy bit of experience, where you begin to feel quiet and peaceful afterward, when the first thing you know, you do something that... that you're reminded that you've done the wrong thing again. And then it's think, well, this was a thought that I had when I was quiet that time. Or so, little things like this, then you begin to realize that meditation is expanding this awareness within you, almost without your knowing about it.
Right.
But it's a reality. And then when we next listen to somebody talk, a few more of the words take root and grow and they mean something. And after a while, as you say, you come to the realization that it's all a pretty simple process. Mm-hmm. It seems like the hardest process is the undoing of the old concepts you had that it was complicated.
Yes, you see, to put it this way, a good many of us, in their own way, have actually achieved the art of meditation.
Yeah.
But can't recognize it. For instance, let's say you're sitting down and you're just thinking. You've been playing in the yard or running around, and then all of a sudden you're tired and you sit down. And then you're looking on the trees and you're thinking, well, gotta go to school tomorrow. Got my homework to do. Gee whiz, and they go into the movies tonight. And you're thinking. And you're trying. But this is a physical restriction from age 0 to age 18 imposed upon us by society. So you're thinking. And there are certain noises are going on, there are certain arguments, and all of a sudden you take off into your own little corner, you sit down and you shut your eyes, you want to shut it out. But then all of a sudden, there's a peculiar feeling coming over. Well, you feel cold or you feel warm, and then you feel joy. You're stumbling right into meditation. You're being forced into the very source of yourself. Now, because you can't recognize it, oh well, get out of this room. Get out of this room and start doing something. Come on, prepare, wash the dishes, fiddle away in the room. Did you clean up your room? Did you do your homework? Same and all. Let's put it in the adult scale. Gotta get up work tomorrow morning. Gee whiz, the car ain't running. It's too cold outside. I should have fixed that washer. And all these things come piling in. Yet, when a brief time you take to relax, then again you seem to go back into it. Now, someone comes along and tell you, well, you need to learn to meditate. This sounds like something weird, fantastic.
Yeah. It's already got 10 times.
All the time you were doing certain approaches or attempts to the thing already, having certain reactions to it. Here is someone trying to put the thing in the... But if you recognize that you have been doing this thing and go back to it now with an understanding that nothing in the actual scheme of life is really going to alter, it is you who are making the changes within yourself to the scheme of life.
This man that was talking to us the other night was telling us about that in trying to check whether some of their work was bearing fruit or how the work bore fruit. He said, we examined the success. this lower or inner levels of consciousness for his creative ideas, you see. And yet he didn't know this is what he was doing. I mean, he didn't know it to the point where he could turn it on or off at will. He always sort of, well, this always makes me feel good, and I always have luck when I, you know, lean back, get my feet up on the table, and then kind of go off into a dream state. But he became successful, nevertheless, due to these periods. So I think it's the same thing with meditation. As you say, some do it unconsciously and are getting results, but don't realize that that's what it is.
I made a mistake. I should have said, good many of us do it uninformed.
Unconsciously.
There is no such thing as unconsciously. We good many of us do it in an uninformed manner. Now, the purpose of group gatherings or religious activity is to do it in an informed manner. Not a formal way.
No.
To be informed on its mechanics and its purpose, its motivation, and to take the utmost out of it. Because you have a choice. If you're uninformed, eventually you're going to find pain following it. And you may find frustration following it. If you are informed, you're prepared to be immunized yourself against the frustration and the pain. You get a sort of spiritual immunity to it. You are prepared for its reactions. You know now that you're informed of what you're doing. You see, this is what I'm trying to bring out about meditation. By being informed in group meditation or individual meditation, you are prepared for the various aspects as they occur. And see, now a guru is with you, and a guru can be in another country at the same time. Now, how are we going to tune in on the guru? Let's see.
Well, I'm not convinced about the guru having anything to do with me yet.
It may be in this way, Mrs. Fuller. You learn to meditate the same as you learn to bang around on the piano, or you learn to do anything you do. But if you are in the presence, and you know always when you're in the presence of someone who can really play the piano, or who can really do whatever it is, including meditate, and you realize that you're in the presence of this teacher of meditation, whether you're here and he's 18,000 miles on the other side of the earth or whatever, when you hit the vibration point where you can become aware, this is when the chela, the student is ready, the guru appears.
Yes.
There's no sense pushing it any further. There's no sense in saying that you might not learn a great deal from other people who are talking about the same thing. You may learn a great deal about how to listen to a piano. You'll learn good things and you'll learn bad things. But when you come into the presence of that person who can really play it, then you will know, and only then you will know, that it's time for you to go and get lessons there and nowhere else. And it may be that it won't be on this plane and it'll be on the...
Yes, you see the thing, what you're saying is this.
That's
in meditation, let us bear in mind that we have to do the work ourselves.
Yeah, this is one thing nobody can do for you.
Right. We have to be acquainted with the instrument we're working with, and that's the human body. You can't trade it in, and there is no U-turn on the road of life. It's a straight one way from birth to the next birth.
Whether
you like it or not. No.
I like it.
There's no U-turn, and it's a one-way run, you know. And you can't trade it in, but someday we'll trade in a new heart for a new heart, and we can change a leg into a paddle, you know, change a nose into a snorkel, and have a parts bank, you know. We'll all these things will come along sometime. But in the meantime, the human body is marvelously built. No one to change it, no matter how it looks. Now, being acquainted with that is being informed as to what it is. Being informed is allowing you to operate it. Now, if you're not informed...
Well, would you say allowing you to operate it intelligently instead of...
Yes, all right. You want to operate this thing intelligently, but you also don't want to make this operation a complicated, drawn-out intellectual tussle with yourself, because then it loses all proportions.
Well,
right. Once you're informed that this mechanism functions a certain way by the scientists of the material world or by the spiritual scientists of the other world, once you've got this information established there, then forget about the information. Do the work. Now, to do the work is to take time out to practice. Now, regularity is important. Now, this is one of the hardest thing about meditation, because regularity entails discipline. That's why the word is disciple. One who disciplines the five senses to the divine self or guruship. God is the guru, all in a human body. The human body came along with full realization and meets another human being and introduces him to this divine principle and takes him through this process. But as long as we understand that information, we must now understand the information that is involving a personal action. Now, I'm not saying that one should not rely on the guru or one should over-rely on the guru, because these are faults in us. These are things we are going to do regardless of how we try to watch ourselves. We're going to be overly relying on the guru to do everything for us, and our time is going to say, well, guru don't exist for me because he's not helping me. You see? Because he doesn't solve my problem. In other words, I got $50 rent to pay and I can't pay it. He doesn't solve my problem. So guru is to blame. It's just as if God is to blame. In other words, we're just using us. We're trying to point out that in the approach to meditation, the fundamental thing is that what this consciousness represents, excuse me, all the time to us. It represents to us all the time the divine creative life. Once we keep this in mind, we are never going to stray. But if we have some other description of what this divine creative life is going to be, we're bound to stray away into some fantasy. But once we realize it's a divine creative life, and this divine creative life has become us, then we will never suffer the fallacy of being separated from it. We will always maintain an affinity of oneness with it. We'll always know that the divine God is always here. It's never somewhere else. It has become us. Now, let me show you something. Why it has become us, and why this thing is so important to realize it as such. The scriptures state, God made man in his own image and likeness. Male and female created them. Now, if you read this from that vantage point, you will think there was some little fellow way off with a fat tummy, which is a symbol of prosperity, that God got to be a prosperous individual, jovial and laughing, and that's a sign of knowing what he's doing, you know, and he's going to create now, take a little bit of mud here, a little bit of there, and you're going to make two individuals and push them out on their own. That's if you read the thing that way and try to understand, that's the way you'll end up thinking of it all the time. But if you try to understand it, the dimension in which it's involving you, then you will see something deeper. God made man, that is to say, this creative principle, this creative life energy, slowed itself down from a conscious flow to a crystallized object. You can't go any further than matter. You can only go back to pure consciousness. So how thick is thick? You see what I mean? How solid is solid? You're solid already. You reached the state of solidity. You reached the state of fixation. In other words, there is no hell. This is the hell, the final fixation of the of your freedom has been taken away and confined to dumb matter. You're confined to dumb flesh. In other words, the thing has already stopped here. This is the final manifestation of the creation. Now, it's all the levels preceding this is where the realizations exist. The preceding qualities is not where it stops. The preceding qualities. So, the image is matter, but that image is atomic. That means matter can exist. The preceding qualities is not where it stops. The preceding qualities. So, the image is matter, but that image is atomic. That means matter is an atomic principle. Now, energy is equal to the mass, this atomic mass, times the velocity of light squared. Now, that Bible said at one time, God made the light first. And every saint in the Bible said, no man see God but saw the light. Now, I'm not talking of a little electrical light. The total cosmic light is light, because all the atoms are composed out of it. So, we are seeing crystallized light. But we don't realize crystallized light until we try to manipulate it by our will. Now, I can't move this crystallized light in the form of flesh unless I will to move it. If I wish my hand to come to the kneecap, I have to wish. That means I have to desire. There's a feeling to move it. There's a need. And if I move it, I have to execute some form of energy. To execute some form of energy, I have to breathe, exhale, or contract and relax. And in so doing, I execute a law that is going on that I don't appreciate. But I take it for granted. A snap and kill a fly. I take that for granted, you see. But look at what is happening to move it, what is involved in the thing. Good.
A lot of principles are in action.
Right, a lot of principles are in action. And we don't realize these principles. Now, this image is the universal image. Therefore, we realize that this image has become us already by stopping at this particular level. Now, where is the likeness of this image? The likeness of this image is the ability to move it, the ability to manipulate these laws. Or else we have no likeness in it. God, the creative intelligence, is manipulating all his laws and holding them in motion. Now, we say God is at rest, but we must not confuse rest as meaning stop.
Within activity,
right? We must realize that rest means total orbiting movement as a whole and as a total existing force. It's there at rest in its orbital movement already. It's not going to go out of its orbital movement unless they change their particular... one of a million chances one object could go out of its orbit and come into another orbit. But they're all orbiting.
To having had an idea, when that idea is out-pictured, your mind is at rest temporarily because the thing has been accomplished. That is where until you sent your mind or idea to out into activity, accomplished its purpose and created maybe a cake, a pie, or a house, or something like that.
Yes.
And then the activity starts all over again with other ideas.
Okay, let's look at it now. We know he has crystallized himself as flesh. We know this because he has given us this capacity of self-knowing. Now, self-knowing is one of the functions of self.
Of what?
Self. Self. Mm-hmm. Now,
with a capital
A. All right. Well, what part of this physical body is self? But this physical body knows. How it knows, why it knows, for what it knows for, he's stumped. This is the dilemma he's in. It knows, though. So knowing it doesn't belong to the body.
No, because the knowing goes on from the body.
All right. So knowing is universally there as likeness. You see? It's a likeness unto us. We are likened to this principle that it knows. Now, it feels and reacts. But what part of us can you say is doing it? There is none. Yet, they all dovetail into this mechanism, and this mechanism vibrates as a placid movement. It goes on all the time. Now, we then realize that there are only two aspects of this manifestation, a male-female aspect. Right. Now, we also realize that we need help. We can't do it by ourselves. If we could do this thing by ourselves, everyone would be realized masters. They would not need, in the first place, any master. Because why we need help? God breathed into man the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Now, he didn't say that man became a living body. He didn't say man became a living mind. He didn't say man became a living spirit. It specifically stated that man became a living soul, not a dead one either. And breath of life had to flow from some point. Breath of life. Now, what you feel when I go into that consciousness is the flow of life is in all of us. And you sense soul, your own soul you sense all the time. You sense your godness. But you are unable to put a finger on it. It's very hard to pin it. Say, well, what part of it that flow through this room? Where? It's passing right through the wood, the stone and everything. It's passing out into space all at the same time. That soul consciousness is going on. Now, you're linked up into it. In other words, every time you realize you are soul, that doesn't say you can remain totally realized there all the time in that consciousness. You drift back. You see, you have a temporary realization you are soul at times, and until you become illumined that you are permanently soul. Then you remain a soul. So you know it for sure. Now, until that time, it's temporary. There are times when you may go to sleep and have inner experiences and totally can't remember them when you wake up, of the soul's nature. Now, even when you're asleep, you cannot say, am I a man or am I a woman? You have no way to say it. There's no way how you can pinpoint it. Yet you know that when you wake up and look at yourself, this particular image, this particular form of the two quality, the two types that this creative intelligence has slowed down to become, I am one of it. Now, does that say that my type or my shape is restricted to eternity for this one? Is it possible then that there is some way that I can have been the other shapes or many multiple interchangeable shapes? You see? Now, realizing that meditation can bridge the gap, the sages have come to us, and that's where the need for the Guru. The Guru comes up to start us off, to bridge the gap. And that's why Jesus says, I have come that ye may have life more abundantly. He didn't say, I have come that you may see God today. I have come that ye may have life more abundantly. God is life. Now, who in the room can say he has more life abundantly? Is there anyone here?
When you say more life abundantly...
I don't mean material goods in the storehouse, you know.
But is this the consciousness of aliveness, the consciousness of alertness?
Life more abundantly... Life more abundantly means that you are a citizen of two realms of existence. While being in this material realm, confined to the physical form, you can vacate the form and go into that unlimited realm. I rebuke you in your rejoicing because I live and die daily in God. He was able to slip in and out of this mechanism. When I say slipping and slip out, I mean his awareness opened up and allowed him to see that other realm and traverse that other realm with a master or a great one and still come back into this realm and accept this realm. In other words, you are familiar with the realms of existence. We came originally from a realm of pure consciousness, which you may call me a ghost. In that realm, I'm a ghost. I don't have a body.
Yeah.
So, I'm a brother ghost or sister ghost. We're all ghosts in that, or we're all bodiless entities, you see. Now, yet memory is there. memory of the association with the different body forms are there. You can't lose that. Now, so, I shouldn't have no fear for a ghost because I'm a ghost already. Now, that is, Thomas said, am I seeing an apparition? No, you're not seeing an apparition. You've seen a flesh and blood body. Come, put your hand, feel these things. Yet this is a peculiar aspect of this flesh and blood body. To show you what is involved in divinity, to show you what is involved in our evolution of life, we are not going back to ghostness because we came from the ghost world. We are going on to a higher level of body reality. That is a body that cannot decompose no more in nature. It's a permanent manifestation of the law of life. But this body exhibits a peculiarity. It casts no shadow. Therefore, it permits light to reflect through it, uninterrupted. Therefore, it can be visible and yet invisible. But that doesn't say it is empty space, because if you take your hand and hit that body in while he's going to feel it. There is a body there. Now, for instance, when Yukteswar came into the room to Yogananda, after he passed through that phase, Yogananda took his physical arms, you know how big he was, and put around that skinny guru and apply a little pressure, you know. He said, come on, son, you're squeezing too hard, you know. He was feeling pain too, you know. So really, it's there. Although that body can do many things, he was still
in a physical body.
Right. Now, this is the thing that all the masses are saying. We have to go to this form. We are walking from the lower level of God's image, as matter, through a higher level of God's image as light, to a permanent level of God's image as non-decaying matter. Now, Star Trek, who has seen that TV show, is an illustration of what will happen mechanically in time, that you can energize the body from here and change its rate of flow and put it in another position. This is what the masters are doing all the time. The masters of truth are masters of manipulating the atomic law that constitute creation.
Well, Matthew said that this business of making your body appear or disappear, going in and out, is a fairly, compared to some things, is fairly simple.
Yes.
It's a matter of changing molecular vibration.
Right. Now, but meditation, all these laws seem so far-fetched and they seem out of our range at the present, but it's not beyond the range of experience. Because those who've had experiences along these lines will say, if you meditate, you will go through it. It's a peculiar thing. You will experience these things through meditation. Now,
I'd like to ask a question. I've always been confused as to what extent is a meeting a guru or a master or a teacher in the physical body necessary. Some of the books I've read indicate, well, when the student is ready, the master appears. Others would indicate that you must meet a teacher in the physical body to help open these various centers. Is there any answer to that?
Oh, yes, there's a very, very, very important answer to it. Very important. You are familiar with this house, right?
Yes.
You have an employer that works for you who have never been here before, right?
No.
Were you to say to that employer, here's the key to my house, go find me my notebook of last month's, I put it in one of the drawers. But you don't tell them what room to put it in. And you don't tell them the color of the notebook, but it's a notebook that's very important for her to make a sale. What is the confusion of that person when they come here? All right, now, if you give them a written description of your house, and the same thing is written down, you didn't speak to them, you wrote the thing down and left it, is the confusion greater?
They can't find it.
Right. Now, but if you as a human being specifically describe it to them, what would they do? When they go specifically to one spot and pick it up? That's the need for a living guru. He's specific as to where he is going because he's already there in the specific form. But we don't appreciate him because we don't see the the control of his existence in that form. We only appreciate the guru when he leaves the physical frame. He does more for us when he leaves the physical frame. But only to those who he has been associated with. For instance, I'll show you. The employee is, has associated with you, and she knows how you talk and what you do. And you have to go away to, say, to Houston on business. The employee, knowing your habits, will begin to think how you would act under certain conditions and thereby follow your pattern of thinking to solve problems under the... See what I mean? Now, when the guru leaves the physical frame, the student starts to think. But the guru hasn't gone away because the guru will come in on another link. The guru will come in on another level. In other words, you can keep tabs on your employee by telephone now. One of these picture phone. You can keep tabs. So she's still seeing your face, but it's still communication going on. And if there's any problem, you're still maintaining contact. It's the same thing is going to happen with the disciple. Now, she doesn't have to see you physically, but the mere voice and the mere that picture phone making contact with her, or a TV thing doing it, she's going to make contact with you. So the guru is still there, you see, but she knows you. Now, let's say I dress up like you, and I paint myself up and put on, and I start talking to her. For a while, she may think I am you. But then she may trip me up with certain information that I may not know of you. You get it? See? So the important thing is to find a living guru to which you have met or associated. And this is one way of going in. Now, the master came and he said there were five masters of realization that were involved in self-realization. He said Babaji, Jesus, Lahiri, Yukteswar, and himself. It is very possible that we may never know what physical form Jesus really has. It's possible we may not know the physical form Yukteswar has, because except those who have lived at the time with him. It's very possible we may not know Yogananda's form except those who were with him. We have photographs, or Lahiri Mayasha's form. Yet, it is possible to know Babaji's form because he hasn't gone over yet. You see? Even we are here, his form is possible. And we have a picture of his form in which we can relate to. Now, when the disciple is initiated, it is not, if he's initiated by another disciple of a master, it is not the disciple who really initiates you. If he was the person who's really initiating you, then we can say we don't need no master. We need a physical master. But who really initiates? Is it the disciple that initiates? Is it the guru or human form that initiates? Or is it God, the divine principle flowing through both the so-called guru and the so-called disciple that does the initiation? Who does the initiation?
God principle.
The God principle. It is until this linkage is realized, we will still think of the form. We still need the form. The form is a stepping stone to the formless. It is the formless that makes this divine life impersonal. It frees us from the limitations of it. You see? Now, Moses had a simple illustration of it. What is your name, God? Because here I'm going to go down to these people and initiate them into the truth of you, your existence, your the reality of you. But these people are accustomed to calling you by names. So I got to give them some name. So, hearing his own consciousness working inside, he said, God, what is your name? And the name that was more appropriate that could ever give him back was, I am that I am. Now, you go tell a group of people who be accustomed to calling their God Taurus or Jupiter or Jehovah that God's name now is I Am That I Am. What they can do with you? Try and tar in front of you. You understand? Because he had reached beyond the point of worshipping the personal aspect of God and realizing God as a total self now. God in a total self had to give him an impersonal answer. The I Am-ness of his own higher self was the truth. Now, a layman caught in it cannot comprehend that. A layman who has been accustomed to looking up as to some personal form needs a personal form. In another way, a lion needs a bigger lion to worship, a cow needs a bigger cow to worship, and a human being sure needs another human being to look up to. Until he can reach that understanding that none of these forms is the end or the limitation of the truth. It is a stepping stone to the truth. Now, the guru eventually doesn't imply that he's a master all the time when you start to go into that inner realm. I'm certain the guru at one point beholds you as brother or an elder brother with the form. And then the time comes when the guru has no form and then you go running. Where are you, guru? You're gone. And then all is but light and you find yourself lost in light and you realize, gee whiz, guru was carrying me all this way by my nose till I was able to walk on my own. Then I realized guru is my elder brother when he was in the form. But guru is God now because I have realized the godness of guru because the godness is me too. It's there we start to see the common bond. We see the evenness of the thing. The guru gives us strength. Gives us the fortitude by being in a human form only for that reason, that we don't assume that we know what this God principle is on its own. We need that physical form as a reminder.
Kind of a focus of our thinking.
Right. Well, let me show you another, far deeper relationship in this guru relationship. Guru is soul. I said before, God made man, and man became a living soul when God breathed the breath of life into man. Man became a living soul, not a body. Not a body. Remember, you cannot look at the guru as body now. Remember, this is the big fallacy of the thing. Why a physical guru or non-physical? God breathed the breath of life into man, and man became a living soul. Now, as long as man continues to believe he has a soul, he will not realize God. He will always think God is something separate from him. He will always think God has made him, God is punishing him, God is rewarding him. And before you know, he will kill his God and bury it too. You know, God is dead, we might as well perform the ceremonial rites of it now, or the funeral rites. So man has reached a point where he is already saying that to himself now, because man is living under the uninformed condition that he is soul. He's living under, he's not informed that he's soul, he's living that he has a soul. You see, he's living under an impression that he has a soul. He doesn't think he is soul. Now, yet God does not leave his creation, that is his own nature, to flounder, because then it will fall apart. If you have an object and it starts to break away gradually and you don't take care of it before you know, disintegrate. Now, if this is humanly true, you mean to tell me creative intelligence that holds this universe is not going to do the same thing too? It has to find a way to maintain its polarity, it has to find a way, it has to set up the laws to compensate itself. It's already done this. We call it the redeeming principle. But it's only a law of polarity, bringing back itself, maintaining itself. It doesn't say we don't need the redeemer. We are looking at the term in a poetical statement, but we must also look at the term in a more objective divine law of truth. We need to be redeemed. But don't look at it as something bad, you know, or something detrimental. We need to be pulled back. All right. So, he knows that his creative power will diminish if it continues to live under the illusion or the impression that it has soul. Because he endowed it already with the power to choose and to abuse that power of choice. So, how is he going to prevent disintegration of his nature? By establishing the redeeming principle or the recompensation or regenerating condition of his own nature. He has to establish that long before he started to create. Before you start to do something, you're busy thinking, how long can I maintain this? How long can I keep it? How long can I look after it?
Just like your job. Yeah.
Right. So, we say insecurity is the game we live by. And God is insecure because he needs our love. And this is true. This is the only thing he cannot get back from this dumb flesh. He made it marvelous. The birds chirp to indicate they love God. The trees sway and give fruit to say they love God. But man will curse, or man may swear, and man may eventually chant that he loves God too. He has the differences. He knows this problem. Now, I'm saying this, that realizing this principle, God already, as the Father, cannot involve himself in his creation no more. He's slowed down into the creation. So he has to generate another nature within this creation to maintain it, which is a recompensing nature, a redeeming nature. Out of that, we got the second quality, son. But don't use it as S-O-N, you know. We always think because my offspring, therefore, he is the boss of the house now. But, you know, we always think that way. It's like the Jewish man says, I got a son, he became a Christian. The rabbi says, yeah, I got a son, he became a Christian. They went to pray, and the Jehovah says, you two got problem, I got one, he's a Christian too. See? There's the problems we're having in our life. But now, the redeeming principle of total creation manifests itself as a sun. That's a bright, brilliant light. The light that shineth that in man, that no man comprehends, the darkness don't comprehend it. The light that shines within us. Now, once a human form realizes this light and its true nature, the bondage is broken. The bonds are broken and soul manifest. And he realizes a heritage. That individual realizes a responsibility. Not to himself. It's a responsibility to the manifested creation that is existing around him. That's the response. In other words, it's not that we are not our brother's keeper. We are our brother's keeper. That's the whole problem. But no one wants to accept the implications of being a brother's keeper. Too much responsibility. And only a master can assume this responsibility. Because he has come home to the soul nature. He is soul now. He is free. He is suffering. He is speaking all our ideas and inspirations through us already.
Well, he has also reached from the mortal to the immortal.
Right. This is established in his nature. In other words, he has reached the two qualifications of God that has manifested in matter. The one manifestation of atomic mass or atomic control, and the other manifestation, the total likeness. That is not impeded. There is no limitation now. These two things fluctuate in him or flow in him. Now, he is soul. He knows this beyond all doubt because he sees it all the time. It's not something that comes to him for a brief moment. It's not something that comes to him in lapse of dreams. It's something that he's totally aware all the time. He is soul. Then he sees the responsibility. Then he realizes why Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, if we knew that we were soul, what forgiveness have we got coming to us? We got any forgiveness coming to us if we knew we were sold and made a mistake?
It seems like you got all forgiveness.
All right. But since you don't know, a master has to forgive you. A more evolved individual has to forgive you for all you do to him. Now, if you are soul, in the first place, when you recognize your soul, it'd be highly impractical, impossible nearby for you to go contrary to the laws of creation. You see?
Yeah.
Therefore, there would be no need for forgiveness. For forgiveness does not exist in the soul, in the true sense of the word.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
You get it?
Yeah.
Because what is there to forgive? Because you are soul. You cannot do wrong. You are total righteousness. You are total truth. There is nothing wrong in soul. Soul has nothing to forgive.
Soul is God.
Right. But man, living under the illusion that he has this soul, needs inspiration. He needs a reminder. That's why a guru comes. A guru comes as a reminder, and it's a relationship between him. The guru lifts him out of the one level to make him conscious that he is soul. Now, but the guru must come in a human form. He cannot come in no other form.
I agree.
What other form? If a guru came from the astral realm, like a TV picture out of the atmosphere, and crystallized himself in the room and spoke, and you not knowing who he is, you're going to do one of two things. Either you're going to fall down and faint, or you're going to take off. You see? But I'm certain you would never stay in that room.
You know, the funny thing to me is people
who've had a master even appear to them. You're not going to stay in that room. You'll faint or take off in some place. All right. If you don't, good. Now, if you are familiar, this person is familiar to you and he manifests to you, then there is an association that's been there. You see? Now, gurus don't act that way because then it would be detrimental to the psychic nature. Now, what gurus do, they take the human form to bring about the evolution of the human behavior, removing the wrong information that this mechanism has soul, to make it aware that it is soul. That is their obligation. They see this responsibility to their fellow man. They are their brother's keeper. Why are they their brother's keeper? Because their brother, that's me, lives under the illusion I have a soul. Therefore, I need that guru until he plucks me out from this illusion that I am soul. I got to be plucked out from the fact that I don't have a soul, but I am soul. Now, to take an illustration, like a lion one day, a lioness one day was running, you know. She was pregnant. And she was chasing some goats. And in the heat of the chase, she fell down and died. But at the same time, gave birth to a baby lion. The goats and the sheep all came around, and mother sheep, it's only natural for them all to gravitate. It's a human maternal feeling. They gathered in the orphan lion into their fold and grew up with them eating grass and crying like a sheep, and ate grass and grew to a full-grown lion, not knowing the difference. One day a lion came down from the hill. Lion into their fold and grew up with them eating grass and crying like a sheep, and ate grass and grew to a full-grown lion, not knowing the difference. One day a lion came down from the hill and saw the sheep all grazing there, and he let out a big, huge roar, telling the world that he is lion. And all the sheep are familiar with that roar from past lives or genetic action, took off for the hills. And the little big lion that lived among them, the sheep lion as you think he is, took off with them too. So the lion who looked in the crowd couldn't figure out why another lion like himself is running from him. So he gave chase, not on the sheep, he gave chase to the lion. And he chased the lion until he caught up with the lion, and the lion almost gave out with fright. And he caught him, he held his head, and he dragged him to the river, and he said, "Hey, you, look at yourself in the water and see what you are. You're not sheep. You're a lion." But he would have almost died from the exhaustion and the tussling and pulling him there, that he was ready to die. He's already given up. So from a sheer last look, he did, took a deep breath, and he says, "Well, now roar like a lion." And so he roared like a lion, and he started to give chase to the sheep. That's the same thing with man and soul. That's the same thing with guru-disciple relationship. The guru shakes us up. He grabs us by the neck, takes us through the various levels of existence to see reality as it is, to see God in us. We need the physical guru, and we need contact with the gurus in the various levels. Now, for instance, guru can come to you in the form of written book, and they are associated by the initiations. Now, in this higher school of awareness, he may not necessarily be the guru for you to take you onto the various levels of inner consciousness. There may be another guru whose responsibility is supposed to take you another step. It's like a school, let's put it this way, it's like a school. Up to a certain level, you have one teacher, or one guru action. Up to another level, you have another guru action. And on another level, there is no guru but God and you. Now this is happening to us, but we don't see it yet. So we take on a physical guru, and through life and death, he takes us up all the way, up to the highest consciousness. And he takes us to that level where you see yourself as a son of God, a radiant light of God. Now, he has already established his sonship. He's already established his soul nature. Then at that moment, he's your brother. But you do not lose the respect because you have already discovered that he is you, that you and I are both lions now. We don't lose the respect, you understand? You still respect the source of time. But you see, you have now not the personal association, it's the impersonal association, because the whole thing becomes impersonal. In fact, as you look around, every face in this room, you see a guru, and everyone who's got a guru will see it. If you have a guru, and you look around, everyone here in his face is your guru. His guru, he will see. And everyone in this room will see guru in all our faces. And at the same time, they will see the gurus and gurus of all. So what are we seeing? We are already seeing God manifesting his infinite wonder over keeping us entertained. So we don't place a limit on God. You see, the thing is this. The human guru is important. And having him in a living form is important. But coming through any contact with a disciple and a guru, that's also the important thing is this. Each one of us has a guru. We may not recognize him right away, but he will come and reveal himself to us. Now, remember one time I said to you, if you were dealing with the Shell station to service your car, and you had a Shell service card, and you're out on the freeway somewhere, and your car broke down, and nearby that freeway where the car broke down, there are about 5 different service stations, but no Shell. And you're approximately 50 to 60 miles away. Ask yourself the honest truth. Would you get on the phone and call your Shell man to bring a tow car to take it in and fix your car? If you need it.
Mm-hmm. No.
Why you wouldn't do it?
Well, I think I'd figure I could get by one of the other ones.
Now, this is true. Our guru, each man's guru is there. But he does not. The guru doesn't always impose his life upon you. Not every time you sit down and meditate, the guru is going to come there all the time. The guru comes at the divine will and in the time you need it. And he allows you, exposes you to many other things of other individuals for certain information. to help you along the path, to reinforce your confidence in the Guru. In other words, those other gas stations will reinforce your confidence in your Shell Station man. It reinforces it, you see. Now, having a physical guru is like, as I said, the only true relationship that can exist, because your parents cannot assume the full responsibility of working out your soul nature. It's not possible. They are not evolved, they're not enlightened to do it. Now, here is an illustration. The man who wrote the Bhagavad Gita, Vyas Muni, had a son. His name was Sakuntala. And when he was born, before he was born, right in the mother's womb, he was taught the entire Bhagavad Gita by his father through sleep therapy, sleep learning. You know, it's just nothing new, because it's the same old principle, but we just make machines to do it today easier, like we make our machines for our prayer. He spoke to the mother with his consciousness and taught the child. The child was born, he was able to parrot out the whole Bhagavad Gita. The child realized his father to be a highly evolved man. The child asked his father to grant him initiation, the light, show him the light inside, let him take that. And the father says, no, not your guru. Now, this man had many disciples of his own, apart from his son being born and fully evolved to a certain extent. He sends him to another man, a king, in some remote area, and told him, that is your guru. He arrives at the court, and what did he see? A king with a big harem, enjoying himself, drinking, dancing, smoking, and this is supposed to be the guru. Now, what a false concept, or what a true concept is the guru? Is the guru a man who drinks, or is the guru a man who kneels down and pray?
Disappointed personally.
Huh? Answer the question now. This father, a fully evolved man, does not assume the responsibility to be the guru of his own child, sends him to someone who he knows from a higher nature is the guru. And when the boy arrives, he sees a man surrounded with beautiful women, he drinking, smoking, dancing. Now, if the boy, according to what he's been trained of a guru or taught as a guru, now the question is a guru a man who drinks, smokes, or is he the man that prays? Now, if you were the son of this great sage, what would be your decision to choose the guru or accept the guru, or if the guru says, I'm your guru? Don't you see what a condition you want to put yourself to now? Because you cannot recognize the guru right away. No matter if you think you have found the guru, if you do not know, you have to have the inner experiences that will come after to tell you. Not the outward experience is going to tell you that it's the guru. That relationship is there. Now, the boy automatically refused to accept such a man as a guru because he knows a guru is a holy man.
That's what it would have seemed to me.
This is the fallacy of the soul, or who believes that it has a soul. See, that's the big fallacy. By believing you have a soul, you automatically assume a guru is a holy man. But if you are a soul, the mere gazing upon that man would tell you that man is guru or not guru. You see, the light would be there. It would be shining in that man's forehead. You would see the light. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven, though you may be a drunkard. Not necessarily who sits in the cell praying and rolling his beads, the light is shining through him. The light may be in him, may be all darkness. You see what I mean? Light has to already emanate out of that being. Now, the guru is coming to the boy. And now he tells the boy, the boy doesn't accept him first, you see, and he goes away. He goes back to his father and he tells his father, he actually rebukes his father. Here's one time where the junior now is assaulting the adult. which is happening today. Sakuntala is looking at the fire and is approaching these holy books that he cherished, that his father had left him and all this, and he's got a little bundle. So he took off one of the wrap from his neck and he started to hit at the fire, just not to come close to his books. And the king looked at him and burst out laughing. Look who is a materialist. Look who calls himself a god man. You're more materialistic than me. You criticize me for being materialistic, but look who's materialistic. You see? Here you are with a few bundle of few old books, and you're busy trying to save it from burning, and I am not even worried about the whole castle. And you criticize me in your mind's eye. I'm a man of women, I drink, I smoke, and all the things. Now, he says, and he looked around, and he clapped his hand, and he stopped the fire. He looked around again, he clapped his hand, and everything went back in its original place. The disciple looked up and he realized, well, this is no ordinary individual no more. He wasn't doing this merely to impress the boy. You understand? He wasn't doing that merely to impress the boy that he was a guru. Because the guru has life and death at his control. Because he's a master, he's realized he's God in, human form working, soul in human form working. It is because he wanted that boy to rid his consciousness of the fact that he has a soul. Now, after the boy realized what was going on, he didn't perform no more miracles for that boy. You know what he made that boy do? He made that boy walk all through that castle from bow to stern, carrying two bowls of oil with fire burning as a test of his concentration. And don't drop a single drop and burn my carpet up. And that boy really walked. And he says, I want you to go into my entire castle, examine every piece of furniture and everything, and come back and tell me what you see. Well, in 10 hours, the boy came back. And the king said to him, what did you see? He says, Your Majesty, I was too busy, too cautious, trying not to drop a single bit of oil and burn your beautiful building down. I didn't have a chance to look. He says, well, you failed the test. Go back to your parents. Well, this is the biggest disgrace a person can have, to know when he goes to his parents and says, my guru don't accept me for initiation. I'm unworthy. And this is the height of, losing faith in the spiritual realm. But he says, okay, I'll give you another chance only because of your father's name. So we see certain things come in to play in consciousness. So he gave him another chance, but this time he never came back. He had to go looking for the boy. And he found the boy in the garden, and he found him with the two bowls of the oil, and he was like this.
Two bowls of oil?
Yeah, burning right down, like a lamp, and he was like that. And he said to him, have you seen the interior of my castle and all its beauty? And the boy said to him, the eye that pierced the light and behold the jewel thereby knows how life exists. Thou alone, O Guru, is life. And the man touched him and he said, you're a cosmic consciousness. Enjoy it. He found the castle, the real castle. That was his whole body. He found everything. He found the jewels there in the seven centers. And he saw the levels in which he had to go. And this was what he was working for. And he realized it was the inner light that this teacher was trying to point out. Now, the human person is important. Now, we've all been initiated to a certain extent. But that doesn't say if a great master was to walk in, and there are many living today, if one was to come in the room and was giving initiation, is there anyone in here who would refuse to take it? Even though
we can find ourselves getting a chance at it.
If at the present you're still there, this doesn't detract from the SRF disciples or the SRF masters of any other masters that exist. Any master that comes must realize who is selling the masters in the first place. You think they come of their own will? They didn't desire to come. They discovered they were soul, and they discovered the responsibility that goes with being a soul-realized individual. They realize that they are shepherds gathering stray sheep for the owner of the ranch. They are working for the owner. In other words, soul realizes that the uninformed being cannot remain in that uninformed state because it will lead to disintegration of the universal principles, you see? And therefore, they yoke themselves to this law. That's the word where yoga comes in. They put themselves in the yoke to drag this responsibility, to assume this particular condition to pull up the fellow man.
Bring up the regenerative factor.
Yeah. Now, even Master would say, he calls himself the eternal boatman. He uses this as a simile of it. I would ply my boat across the Stygian Sea of life a million times, to bring one erring brother back to the soul light. In other words, if you can imagine, this consciousness is always going to reach out. Now, every master, that is, everyone who has realized that he is soul, realizes the universal responsibility. Now, in the story of Cain and Abel, when Cain killed Abel and he was called to account for it, he said, "Am I my brother's keeper?" But you see, Cain does not know, in other words, ego doesn't know its soul. It's only the soul knows its soul, and the ego destroys any attempt that the soul...
Or blinded to it for the time.
Right. See, Cain was blinded by his own ego. Now, the same thing is that a man doesn't want to accept his soul because he realizes that it's too big a job. It's a big job. This is not an easy thing. You can realize this is not an easy thing to say to someone, "I accept you, Guru. I place my full life, I surrender and take the responsibility of your discipline." And now the Guru can be have an iron-fisted type of discipline, or he can have a loving discipline, or any type of discipline. But it's very hard, because what the Guru puts upon us can wreck many of us, but it doesn't kill us.
Well, look.
It's like in Marley's case, you see? In Marley's case, the knife flipped out of the garburetor, and went right into our eye. Now, what can be more damaging to lose one's sight? Now, it could have killed her, but it didn't. And I'll give an illustration in my own life. Slipped off 30 feet from the building, hit the ground. It was up to me to die or live. So, Master didn't give me all, I prayed for my karma, yes, but here it is. I am in the ground, and all my bones are... I have 54 compound fractures, and still he did not cut the life stream and say, "Okay, go on." Because in the consciousness, when I was ready to accept death, because I fell down, I said, "Well, I knew I couldn't get up," in my own case. And I said, "Well, gee whiz, I was seeing life all through going on." I said, "Boy, this really is, what is this? What's going to be more beautiful than this whole good great creation? What does they need this body for? Let me just live in this realm forever." Can't. The point is, you have to come back down. In other words, the timing come. You got to live in this. Learn more lessons of this human form. Learn lessons that are important to this human form. The only way you're going to learn it is by passing through these tests. So I have to go through pain and suffering and almost death too. Well, the heart stopped twice on the operating table. So even that, the Guru never stopped his love.
No, that's just what made
me
crazy.
No. Yeah, that made me crazy for sure. It sure made me crazy. Well, now, you see, when I meditate, if I build up the image of Master's form, I am holding back the Master too. Because I am relying on that form to bring home communication to my being. I realized I have to break that too. And one night I was meditating and I saw the form, and then the form disappeared. There was no form, just light, peace. So I realized now, the formless God is the reality of myself. I have to learn to accept, to live with this thing, with true love for the first time. Now this is quite a pain. It's a painful thing to all of a sudden lose an association with a form, you know, of someone that you are familiar with, and then to slowly dissolve into light. Yet.
Isn't it sort of a dependence that you have too, that you lose on this other?
In a sense, you can call it that, but really no, it's not a dependence on the form that you really lose. It's a re-evaluation of what the form is doing in that dimension of existence for you. You have to re-evaluate yourself and look at it and say, really, without this form, God could never communicate to my form. Without having used form as a medium of communication, it would never be possible for me to accept the reality of myself. It would never be possible to accept inner light. It would never be possible to want to grow in light. It's because he has used form, and it's because we have been constantly reminded of form. That's why we're bringing back to what Paul is saying, we need a living guru or a friend here. It is because this is the way of righteousness. That's why, you see, Jesus, when he was baptized or initiated by John, his guru, as I said one time, he came to this Jordan River and he saw this guru standing there, and he said to him, you baptize me. That means you initiate me. You open this inner light. And John says, no, you do it because you're more evolved now. But he says, no, you do it because this is the way of righteousness. Now, picture for one moment two grown adults debating at a critical moment of water there who to bathe who. You can see it doesn't really mean that. It goes into a depth. It takes the student to recognize that master. And he recognized that this was his master. He recognized it. It had to come from an inner awareness. Now, we may meet various teachers who will initiate us, but then one teacher will come along, and automatically you gaze upon him, you've known you've had an association from way back in time, and you link up. But it's there. But these are all different associations with the guru. The guru is always there. Now, the masters say you have one guru for life. Well, that one guru for life is God, working through various human forms to bring you back to him. Now, at one incarnation, you might have been sitting down at the feet of Arjuna, who was a fully illumined prince after he was illuminated by Krishna, and listening to a discourse. And in another incarnation, you might be sitting down at the feet of William the Conqueror, listening to a discourse. Or another incarnation, you might be sitting down at the feet of Saint Francis and listening to a discourse. And another incarnation, you might be sitting down at the feet of Yogananda listening to a discourse. But is it Yogananda? Is it Saint Francis? Is it William the Conqueror? Is it Arjuna, who is the guru? Are these not the forms, the suit that the guru wears, that God wears all the time to bring the soul back? God is the eternal life, using many suits, many incidences, many roles of life to bring back what? Not to bring back Adana's physical body. Because what is Adana's physical body? This is tissue. It's a classification, the name given to a form. But what is talking? It's life talking. Life is communicating. Life. Now, it's very hard to say, is life male or female? We can only see when it breaks up in the cells and it starts to appear off. But actually, the life in the male cell or the life in the female cell, is it not life? They're all life. It's all God flowing back. So this is what's happening. The guru is making us, or God is making us conscious that we are soul in the form of the guru. All the time. That we are soul. He wants us to realize this all the time. He wants us because he made us in that image, he made us in that likeness, that capacity, and he endowed us with this principle of life, to know it that we are soul. There's no other way else we can go to it. So Jesus says, this is the way of righteousness, this is the way you got to go back. You have to return via the form principle, via the guru principle. Now, many of us can go about shouting, we don't have need of a guru in order to discover God. But you know, many masters says, I'd hate to be in the presence of man who found God without a guru, because he's a highly inflated egotist. He says, if he had found God without a guru, certainly God would not have had need of masters. We need masters.
Well, my only problem is that I need one and don't find it, so I guess I'm just not ready.
No, wait a minute. The masters are coming true all the time. They will come true. The masters are coming true. I don't say a master. The masters are the various sons of light, God light, are coming true in human form with full awareness and enlightenment. Because right in this human form and on this continent, there are many souls waiting for the illumination of themselves. You will be exposed to the divine truth handed down more and more. You'll be ground into it gradually until you are fully filled to the point that when the physical illumined being walks through the room and initiate you, you may accept the initiation and not know him to be your master. You may accept the initiation and know him to be your master. But only when you have the inner experiences, when he takes you across the threshold of light inside of yourself, that you know that this particular one is the guru for that particular period of that consciousness going back. Now, you may recognize, put it this way, Master once said this, no one would come to him who was not a disciple of his in the past life, but would not recognize it. Now, let's say, had I sat down at the feet of St. Francis in a past life, but cannot recognize it in Yogananda, I haven't recognized St. Francis. Yet, Yogananda can reveal St. Francis through his mechanism to me if he wanted. And I look at Yogananda, I wouldn't see Yogananda, I would have seen St. Francis.
Oh, really?
Right. Only because I might have had the association with St. Francis from a past life. Now, a guru will sit down in this room, and if you have an association with a great saint in a past life, and you don't want to accept his present form as the guru, he will work the consciousness that you will see through his body who that guru was in a past life where you did sit to the feet and took lessons. But then you will wake up to the reality, hey buddy, for a moment, what happened? You only incarnated now in this new body form to teach me the same thing I followed up with in the past one. If I goofed as a Catholic monk in some past incarnation at some other monk's feet because I didn't grasp the inner truth, and seeing it now presented in yoga form and don't grasp it yet, I'll still go need another human form someday to grasp it as calculus and integral mechanical movements. So eventually I've got to grasp it. You understand? So the point is this, is whenever you grasp the truth, it'll come into you. The guru does that. Yes. You will recognize. Yes, you. That is true. You see, the Satguru in a given period is to reinforce this portion of creation, dumb flesh, that cannot avoid craving an association. I once said before, early in the evening, a lion would love to have a larger lion as his god. You can't see man as his god, you only want to eat him or obey him. But if he saw a bigger lion than himself, he sure would bow down and worship him. Now a man would not bow down to a lion, but he would bow down to a superman. which you call a God-man. You see what I mean? So we need the affinity to worship. That's why Jesus says, this is the way of righteousness. This is a principle. We want something that we have to reach up to in our form, our makeup. No.
Yeah, it sort of seems silly when I acknowledge to myself once in a while that I want something I can reach up to, but that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. No, there are those who have already passed through that road who come in as rishis. Well, even when you come in as a rishi, like take the Maharishi of Arunachala. Here he was, an illumined soul from a past life. Now, at the age of 13, he read a few scriptures, and all of a sudden, he decided to make the acid test.
See whether he
if he's soul or he has a soul. So he pretended to die. And he tried to simulate the effects of death. No, so he got in a cave and he tried suspended animation, or trance, as you want to call it, or cataleptic condition. And he tried and he tried. And at the end of the third day, he was called Rishi. He woke up with the awareness that he was always known this before. So the question comes up now, where did this man get his, where is his guru? Where is the Maharishi guru? You see, where is the guru for this man? But he had a guru. If the individual who didn't write that information down and leave it for him to go and read it, and if he didn't have some affinity to the author and try to experiment, how would he go practice this thing? If he all right, he read that this man, this particular saint, wrote this thing down in this book. So let's say the saint name is Ram Singh. So he went in the room and he started, oh, Ram Singh, I'm going to try to die. But he still had to call on that particular author. He's going to duplicate the author's instructions. And when he did accomplish the feat, he saw the guru standing there was himself. But also that author was just a fulfillment of the same thing too. Because then he realized, it's like in the case of Ramakrishna. Ramakrishna did something for everybody which we fail to realize. Ramakrishna studied every religion and attained illumination in all of them. He studied Christianity and attained illumination in it. He studied Buddhism and attained illumination. He studied the Quran and attained illumination. He studied Hinduism and attained illumination. He studied the Sufis, he attained illumination. And he ended up saying, the way to God is the Guru. That all his disciples, his most advanced disciple, Vivekananda, said, to me, you are my God, you are the Guru. He couldn't see nothing else. He says, he saw God in all of these things. He saw in all the scriptures, he saw the same, he saw the Gurus in all of them. He saw a Guru in all of them. He didn't see one was more important than the other. If you can find illumination in reading one scripture and see the same common bond in all these scriptures, you are found Guru. God is the Guru. But there's always going to be some human contact that brings you to the path. And this is what you want.
That's what you're...
Yeah.
Pretty wonderful.
You still need a Satguru, I think, to take you from where you are when you realize that there's a guru to...
I did not say you don't need... You see, you're confusing something with an issue of a Satguru. The word Sat means existence already, the eternal existing consciousness. The only thing that exists in this universe is not man. The thing that exists in this universal is conscious life, which we know as God. We know as God, which we realize has become us in the form of man, and which we need in the form of man to re-establish our identity with it. Could you follow me that clearly? Do you see the process that is involved in a thing like that? Now, a Satguru is only a specific statement of such a realignment that because we are not equipped in our limited thinking of not having a soul, we need this physical illustration. If we never had physical illustrations of what soul qualities are, we cannot follow it. If by merely reading alone of soul qualities, you're not going to practice it. But because there are instances in life when soul qualities are demonstrated by matter, to illustrate to matter its true nature, we follow a living guru, because here is an example. Lives of great men all remind us we should make our lives sublime. They going ahead of us, leaving footprints on the sands of time. But without an example, a guru is an example of soul in motion. Now, if you are born in 1863 and Kirpal Singh is born in this period, where would the two meet? If you died in before you came into this body, you follow me? Or if Charan Singh is born in this particular period and you were born way back in 17 something, where would the two meet?
There's always a manifestation of the guru in a line of succession that does not end. Then you have
this does not this be, the gurus will always tell you, you have a way to go back to God, and a line of succession is a simple statement. We must not confuse this statement, a line of succession, with a personality. The link between one master to another is the one principle of truth that is being transferred on. I cannot come and tell you, if I am a teacher of the Baptist faith, to follow Catholicism, when all my teachers behind me were teaching me the Baptist faith. Now, I am a missioner for the Baptist faith. If I'm a missioner for the Catholic faith, I'll teach you Catholicism. If I'm a missioner for the Sufi faith, I'll teach you Sufism. If I'm a teacher of any faith, that's the faith I'm teaching. Now, these masters are not teaching no faith of no particular group. They are teaching us the reality of ourselves, because they have experienced the reality of themselves. You see, this is a vast difference. They are teaching us doctrines. So a man who wants to know the truth about himself must seek out men who have the knowledge concerning the self, and that link back with men who have achieved this realization. Certainly I wouldn't go to a Baptist minister to find out how this mechanism works. That doesn't say he may not be acquainted with it in his writings. But if he is aware of how it functions within himself, you mean I'm going to trust my automobile with a refrigerator mechanic? You follow what I mean? You're not going to do a thing like that. So to say to someone he needs a Sadguru and a line of Sadguru, you're not really communicating what is necessary for the person to equip himself for. What the person has to equip himself for is to realize that masters of life principles teach only that, how to realize yourself. They don't teach anything else. Therefore, there is no conflict in none of the masters of life. Though they be the very sparks or the very cause of which all religions seem to spring from and maintain itself, these great masters seem to be the fountainhead for it. But they, when they get together, what do they talk about? They talk of light, they talk of sound, they talk of divine consciousness and peace. Now, there are certain levels which our five senses and our memory patterns and certain desire patterns have caused certain restrictions on this life principle. It has placed certain restrictions to prevent us from recognizing we are soul. Therefore, we are hung up. We're stuck with these peculiar patterns. We can't seem to get out of it. And by not being informed how to get out of it, and having no one to turn to get out of it, books are not enough. A mere getting together in the group is not enough. You need some human form to consult with. You need somebody in a physical way to tell you how to get out of it. So I'm not saying that the Sadguru in any period of time or in any human body form is unimportant. I'm saying the time comes that you will lock on to one in any time sequence. You will come to when you have those problems to solve. You see?
Well, I perfectly agree with you. All I'm saying at the same time, though, is that all Veena players will agree as to the beauty of the Veena.
Yeah.
but that there is very likely in a given time a gene of clarity. And that's important to recognize. And that's
yes.
part of the search, too. Certainly you want to search for...
Wait a minute. I agree with what you're saying. Part of the search is to find a guru. Is it part of the search to latch on as a leech to the guru?
No.
Then what is the real search?
The search is to understand the game.
Then if the real search is to understand oneself, then the guru is an example of what oneself is supposed to aspire to.
Sure.
That's why I say the only relationship that does exist is a guru-disciple relationship. But this is in an impersonal statement. It's not placed upon a personal basis that I must have this physical personal person sitting down here to talk to me all the time. I accept the physical form as a measurement through which I can reach my inner self, but I must also see it as an example through which I can measure. In other words, if I have a reference, if I have a diagram, I can build this kit, I can build this object. Now, the characteristics of a guru is not to demonstrate miracles. If that was so, I don't need a guru at no time. What I need from the guru primarily is how to behave in a world comprising human beings and verbal communication where a word from one person with a wrong tone of voice can hurt you for years. A same word with a certain tone of voice can make you your best friend for years. I want to know how to survive and live in this universe where this is happening, that love permeates the communication, where human association is communicating. Because this leads me to freedom. It leads me to an understanding of self. Now, this would be exactly what the Beatitudes entail. They entail attitudes of behavior. Now, Jesus said, none come unto the Father but by me, but he's not implying that you imprison yourself to his physical form. He's implying that you get to the depth of the thing, to get to the inner meaning of the thing, the inner workings of the thing. Now, we do meet a living guru, and a living guru gives us diksha, or initiation. And he gives us darshan, what is called a booster charge. Why? Because we are not souls yet. We haven't realized that the condition. We are still laboring with the fact that we have a soul. Now, unless we see the human form at some time, we will not be able to eradicate from our consciousness that we have a soul. You see? Now, even though you listen to me tonight and here, you cannot walk out of this room honestly and say to yourself,
I am soul.
Can you honestly eradicate and walk out of this and feel this fully? But if you see a living master sitting in the room, emanating this inner awareness to you, and you can lock onto it, and you can walk in that realm with him. And I don't mean walk from here to the bathroom or out in the yard. I mean really walk in consciousness with him. Then you know soul. See, and that is only the reason why the guru is there. He's there to make you conscious. Now, as long as this is necessary by the creative intelligence, this is a necessary thing. It's right, it's established that man must have a contact. He cannot go out of this physical frame without having one physical contact with a human being that is in that particular level of consciousness. This is what I admit is necessary. Now, that doesn't say I must go looking for the man. If God is working through us, he is bringing that man into your life.
You see? I know that. I mean, people here went... You can give names of books and names of teachers, but if the teacher wants them, the book will turn up in the back seat of the car with you.
All right, the point is this.
The teacher will suddenly walk through the
door. Right, the thing is, the teacher walks in the room. Let's say, here's an illustration of a consciousness. Let's see your reaction. many things have happened. Let's see what is your reaction and see if you can point out what have you recognized, what have you felt. You see, truth is demonstrable. It's not something you just merely talk. It's something you have to live. What can you recognize in that gesture?
What is it that you and, say, Mrs. Manchester, or anyone here, Mrs. Hardaway, Boris, Lucille, are all people who are aspiring and have arrived at an understanding, and that from any of you there can come lessons. But the important thing I still have to go back to is that I know that from all the lessons I can learn here and from what I have still to accomplish, there still has to be this inner journey. And this still has to...
The inner journey, you see, the thing is what you're not recognizing. When we step out apart from the pull of this mechanism and feel the free flow of consciousness, you're always in the presence of Guru. Now, your guru is always in a state of illumination. If you have never met him, he's still standing next to you. Because you don't make an attempt to step out of the pull of your body or the demands of your body. He'll wait till the time comes when he'll have to break you from that confinement. And then you can walk out of being it. Now, this is the carryover we're trying to point out. Now, some people, this has happened to already, long time. It has happened to many people on that particular condition. And when they've walked out, they have seen various masters waiting to greet them. Yet, when a physical master does walk through the physical plane, they will go with respect to that person and get his physical contact for one good reason. The one good reason is, this is flesh and it ain't gonna accept beyond our reason of doubt that everything that is happening on the inner plane is real. No matter how fantastic or how miraculous it will perform for it, it still wants to know he's living in the, he's meeting a human being. That's the peculiarity. This flesh is afraid. It's afraid, and God made it to, in such a peculiar way, to want to accept human beings to what we call huddling together like monkeys.
I'm so glad you said that. I feel justified.
We see, meeting a living master is one who's enlightened already. He's gone the whole gamut. He's already pure consciousness. He's in God realization. He can come to you in many levels. He can come to you while he's in his physical body, living way off in India, and make you conscious that he is the Guru. And he may never come to you after that in the physical body. He may come to you while living in India in a physical body, come to you in the inner plane, make you conscious of his existence. He's in the human body. He's not dead yet. He's in the human body. And yet, may never come to you in the physical body. And you ask yourself, why is that? And he may not come to you that way. He may come to you in a travel through the physical body and wait for you to slowly recognize him and work through. And keep fondling you on till you break that association. That when he's away now from you in vision or physical sight, you have to learn to rely to see him inside now. What is that guru really doing? Don't you see he's performing something for a reason? He's freeing you from certain conditions that you've long mastered or certain conditions you need to master about yourself. Yogananda, I did not go up to see his physical body. I never wanted to see the master's physical body in this incarnation. In other words, I had a deep set conscious feeling way back in consciousness or time that the human body, I've seen enough masters in the human body, I sat at their feet a long time. I wanted to travel in the consciousness inside myself. So when I came across, the first experience from him was in the inner plane. And from that day on, I said, I'm not coming to see you in San Francisco, in California. And I never went. And one of his disciples, this was funny, they did not know, his name is Kriyananda. On three occasions, he made an issue of this thing. He said to the master, why don't we bring Mr. Lee here and let him stay here and be a minister and be trained in the ashrams? And the first time he asked the master, and you know what the master said to him? He told me himself from his own mouth, and other people told me about it. He said, Yogananda replied and said, what is he going to do here? Look at the palm trees? He's doing the work he's supposed to do where he is. In other words, I was solving the problems that the guru-disciple relationship involved. I was solving the necessary disciplines where I was. In other words, I've already accepted the guru is God. I've accepted this whole universe as a school. And I accepted the fact that in this life form, Yogananda's body as it was God is the new teacher form. What do I have to see him in this form? Can a teacher not teach by public address system without the students seeing him and still get the same information? And knowing he's existing in the top floor, it's a matter of how you set up your consciousness that the guru can work for you. You follow what I'm saying?
Well, I think you still might go to the physical form of the master for the darshan for your physical form.
All right, I'm going to show you something as you talk about the physical form for the darshan. I meditated where I was. That's the first time Kriyananda asked this master that. The second time he asked him the same question. He was giving a Kree initiation to many of my friends that I have sent to SRF. And he was performing this Kree initiation that year in California, which was the largest performed that year. And normally a person don't get the initiation until, only 2 years or lessons. I'd only started this course in a matter of 6 months. I did not want to see his physical body because I knew right away, if a guru, you don't have to go pestering a human body, but you're going to pester it because you're only going to see consciousness and you're going to see the illumination there, and it's up to you now to make the effort to get in that consciousness. I decided to stay home, and I was living in Canada at the time, and meditate. This was my duty. My duty to my God was to sit up and meditate, and this is what I had to do. I had to do it. Nobody's going to do it for me. I got a letter. This initiation was going on a Saturday. I got a letter from California on the Friday. And in the letter was a set of lessons on the Kriya initiation. And a letter stating, prepare yourself to be initiated tomorrow at 7 o'clock, your time. Now, every one of my friends had paid hundreds of dollars to go to California just to see the master to be initiated in the physical form. As long as he was in there, they were going to get initiated in the physical form. And here I am instrumental in helping them to all go there. And I am not going. You follow what I'm saying? So I should be the one who should be very happy after having these experiences of want to go see the man in the human body, right? More so than trying to make people want to go there. I sat in my house and I sat down to meditate. And just about 7 o'clock, like some great force had drawn all the air out of the room. There's not a single noise. And I can hear, like if I were hearing all the atoms in nature just vibrating. And I felt a thumb And I say, he had a big hand, he really has a big hand, because that thumb was big. Knocked my forehead right here for about 2 seconds, and I tell you, I was gone. Totally. I didn't go nowhere out of my body, but my consciousness was all in space, back and forth, just flying back and forth. I knew peace, 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 there was nothing else but peace. And levels of peace and levels of peace just kept going on. And I realized that I didn't have to go looking for the physical guru. I'd long been freed from that imprisonment of physical form, that the guru now was the eternal life. And I heard deep down in my consciousness, this consciousness just vibrating, it is done. I never saw the master. I meditated for years after that. I never saw him in any other astral form. He never came to me in any other astral form. He only came once. The day he died, or he left the body, I was going home. I arrived, there was a telegram. And I opened the telegram, and I read, he just passed away. Well, there, I'm going to show you human recriminations. I started to swear, and I kick up the floor. I said, what a damn fool I was. I should have gone there and seen the man while he was in a human body. You need to see the Satguru in the human body. You must have human contact. And here I'm going through exactly the rigmarole talk of the same thing. I should have gone. I lost. What have I gained? I've only got a few inner experiences and building my consciousness. Here, the thing that was more important now was to see that human body. See how human form was human form? A lion needs a bigger lion to look up to. I need to go and see. Deep down, there was something still missing. I should have gone and see. No sooner I had said that, I felt my eyes close down. And I heard like a huge voice say, who is dead? I'm alive. You know it all. And like that, I knew he was lifting off karma from my mechanism like mad. And I can see all these things moving in consciousness. From that day on, I knew the whole course of the SRF without even looking at it. I didn't even read the balance. The thing had worked. What I wanted most to know about, I wanted his blessings from that realm without having to go and say, I was touching human form and satisfying human form. I wanted to know that really, divinity was working from any level, from any time and space, could reach out to man and touch it. In other words, I was trying to really appreciate his existence in California, which I call the podium of the church, and Canada, where I was living, pew 93 at the back of the church. And all the masses were up standing taller above me, and I'm sitting back here trying to peek through the crowd to see where the guru is. But at last I can feel what that light was coming down was enough for me, because this was how I was. I had already accepted the guru consciousness. I was no longer looking for physical form no more.
That would be one thing that you needed to have, you see, the same as there was an initiation in Dallas last spring, and I was out at White Rock Lake at the same time. Yeah. I know what you're talking about, that you can know the form is doing what it is doing, and be somewhere else and still feel it. I mean, it's just the same as you can know your master here, the master may be in India, or the master may
be that's what you're trying to achieve. You're trying to achieve soul awareness. You're not trying to achieve body awareness. If you want to achieve body awareness, no.
But what I'm saying also, even though you wouldn't, some people go to see the body presence and then they never achieve the soul presence. Well, certainly you'd want to achieve the soul presence. But having achieved the soul presence and the soul awareness that over the space you had it, you might still, for the sake of your body and for the sake of your darshan, go and see the master.
Yes, I'm not saying no. I don't say that. That's what the human form wants. That I tell you why it needs it. There's a very good reason for needing it. We are nurtured out from this, the principle of sensation of touch, because this whole human body is touch. This whole human body is touch, and it's the only true sensation that you've got left, apart from sight and hearing and tasting and smelling. Because you touch the universe with your eyes. When I look at you, I touch you through my eyes in some form, because I can reach out and touch it. I can touch you through my hearing. I can touch you through my nose, but they are imperfect in their actual touch when I can reach out and say, good evening, how are you? There is a transfer So because of that, there is a tremendous cellular need for sensational touch, and love can only be transferred in a profound way between two beings except by touch. And the profoundness of a master's love for his disciple is most enjoyable when you go out and get that physical touch from him. There is no greater physical association after that, because this is something you have lived through in a biological way with him. Now, that sensation, that electrical charge that is transferred and is tingling through your body, this, if it remains years after he gone on to other forms of existence, and you can reach out and feel it, this is what will keep your faith going and what will keep the devotion going. But if you've never felt, as I said, I felt this huge big thumb, and it didn't matter if I went to Los Angeles and I knelt down there and he put that big thumb, what would I feel more than that, that one that he's really putting there in time and space? In other words, he was reaching out through time and space in that dimension of consciousness and touching me there. All the letters said, prepare yourself for the initiation. And I sat down in front of the table, that little altar I had, and I waited. And it was just like a human hand. And there were times when I myself and Sonny would be meditating, and I could feel that big hand, he puts it around your neck. And you can feel it, the master puts that hand in. And you feel that that power is there. Now, you don't have to want to see the man high, and I see it. Once you know, it's a reassuring effect that he can reach out, this consciousness can reach out through time and space, through dense matter, and affect you. This is what you're trying. This is a greater realization you're going for, because then you're not walking with the fact that you're hanging on to Guru's shirt tail. Now, the masters have always said there are two ways to live with the Guru. You see, there are two ways to live with the Guru relationship. One is like a cat and a kitten. The other is like a monkey and its baby. Now, a cat and a kitten, the cat picks the kitten by the neck and drags it and puts it in one place and leaves it, and comes back and moves it from one place to the other. That is what you call the total surrender to the divine will of the Guru, never questioning him for no movement.